Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
Among the most difficult jobs in the public sector in Massachusetts, at least, is running the MBTA. No question about it.
What I don't want to see is people being laid off. I want to see continue seeing people go back to work.
I'm very worried that the Fed is going to tip this economy into recession.
Are you suggesting that we abolish the MBTA?
I think that's probably where we need to start. Heads have got to roll.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Joe Shortsleeve, and Kim Kerrigan on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 92.9 HD2.
And it's Tuesday, February the 7th. Welcome to the 2 o'clock hour of Bloomberg Bay State Business. We have a jam-packed show for you with some breaking news as well. Joe Shortsleeve, Tom Maroney, Kim Kerrigan, and Mastu Janet Wu. 34 degrees as we come on the air with cloudy skies here in downtown Boston. Equity markets, they've been all over the place. Right now they are in the red. Headline on the Bloomberg Terminal, stocks drop as Powell says peak rate may be higher. Powell says further rate hikes needed amid strong labor market. Comments he's making only on Bloomberg. Okay, the breaking news today, we're talking about former Boston Mayor and current U.S. Labor Secretary Marty Walsh. Bloomberg has confirmed that he is on track to become the next executive director of the NHL Players Association. This is apparently going to become official sometime after the State of the Union, which, of course, is taking place tonight. Bloomberg has confirmed this, but it was first reported by news outlet The Daily Faceoff. They talk about a salary of some $3 million for Marty, allowing him to work in Boston. But Tom and Kim, I know that when on the surface of this, when you see this, it feels like, okay, that's perfect for Marty Walsh, you know, with his labor background, the whole bit. But I'm just wondering, would we be talking about this? Would this be happening if what happened to Charlie Baker, you know, hadn't happened just a couple of weeks ago, heading to the NCAA? Do you think there's any connection?
I don't. I mean, I think it's all coincidence. I think these two are very close friends.
I guess I just mean it sort of caused maybe a change in thinking, like this Marty in this position is going to be the first person without a law degree. I don't know.
Well, he brings all this other cred to the table that the others haven't. I mean, look at this. He was head of the Boston Building and Construction Trades Council. He talks about that all the time when he's been on this program. You know, he pulls you over to the window here at 106.1 Studios, and he points down to where his dad worked as a laborer on the building next door. And, Ann Moss will join us in a minute, and she's going to have a kind of a history of where he's been with all this. So, no, he's not a lawyer, but he's Marty Walsh.
He's Marty Walsh.
Well, and he's labor secretary.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and I think that is a really big
part of
it.
That might be a little bigger title than attorney, don't you think?
And it's even bigger than mayor of Boston, truth be known, when it comes to this situation. I do think it's interesting that he's not an attorney and that they've chosen him. But I've always envisioned that Marty was destined to be the head of some big labor union. And I'm not so sure that he's not destined for bigger than even the NHL Players Union, because that's his first love. There's
well,
no
and as far as
it.
Them being interested in Marty Walsh, it doesn't hurt that you not only have worked for the president, the sitting president, which
but he likes you and you know
very
him.
Fond of
right.
him. Oh, yeah. I mean, that does not hurt when you sit down and figure out who's going to lead this group.
Know? Well, again, Bloomberg has this story all confirmed, but the Daily Faceoff, which first reported it, suggested that perhaps Marty not getting the chief of staff job in the Biden White House was a catalyst to him looking at other possibilities. Mm. But, Kim, as you pointed out, you know, I'm sorry.
$3 million plus
for a kid from South Boston.
You bet.
Right.
It was. Hey, from a guy who lives in Swampscott, it looked pretty good too. In an area that he had not been in. So I mean, you start waving that kind of thing with the opportunity to work in a really high profile union situation, and not to mention the fact, guys, that what we seem to have found out here is that he, like Charlie Baker, will not have to leave home.
Yes.
This is based in Toronto,
correct.
But he's not going to Toronto. Well, so his negotiation skills must be pretty good.
Charlie's not going to Indianapolis.
Yeah, right.
Well,
these guys are staying
this
home.
Is where Baker might have come in handy. He might have called his old friend and said, hey, you get to work at home, right?
Right.
Says, here's what you do.
Right.
You
know? But negotiation is what he's getting into this to do. So he better be able to negotiate his own deal.
The other thing that ought to be said, I mean, this is sort of a trajectory for these folks. I mean, they do serve, you know, there's a midpoint or somewhere where they say, okay, I've done my public service, and the president says, you know, you're free to go. The president is the guy that calls all this. And,
sure. Love to hear that conversation, wouldn't you?
I would imagine it was warm, and just like it's been with those two. I mean, Biden would drop in on Boston just to go see Marty, but then you go and you get a big, you go cash out, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good for him.
Well, I think it's not unusual to see them start to step away after this, you know, the two terms years in. And you've been following the whole thing all day, which you know what I think is really interesting is that last week, Friday, there was a real telltale sign when Walsh was asked by Bloomberg about this jump.
That's right. Jonathan Farrow asked Marty Walsh about it on Jobs Day.
It's because there's some interest in perhaps maybe you going to the NHL Players Association. Any truth to that, Secretary Walsh? There was a report from Politico this week.
I don't have any personal news to make today. Today I'm focused on a jobs report that has shown since the President Biden has taken office, 12.1 million people have either gone back to work or jobs been added to the economy. And you know, certainly, I this is such an honor being Labor Secretary. And on a day like today, I feel even better about it, being able to be on TV.
That sounds like you've got some news to make tomorrow.
I live my life a day at a time, so we'll see what happens.
Secretary Marty Walsh.
Again, there with Jonathan Farrow. You know, Bloomberg was on it. We caught wind of this news last week. And, you know, I'll add that it's significant for several reasons. Walsh is the first member of President Biden's cabinet to step down. His reputation, as you were saying, for negotiation, mediation, has gone from the Building and Construction Trades Council here in Boston to the national stage. Soon he'll represent, obviously, professional hockey players in Canada and the U.S. The NHLPA announced last April that it was searching for a replacement for Donald Fair, who's 74 years old. His salary is believed to be about $3.5 million annually. So this obviously is a huge step up for Walsh. And it's expected that Walsh will make comparable money and live in Boston. The association's based in Toronto, but it's understood that he'll live in Boston. He's been in the Department of Labor since March 2021, and as you were saying, has led it through a number of large labor disputes. One was just of requiring COVID-19 vaccines at workplaces and updating those rules on whether workers should be considered independent contractors or employees under federal wage law. He also oversaw the upgrades, the modernization of the Office of Unemployment Insurance, because they had to address the technology that was leading to millions of dollars lost to fraud and delays during the pandemic. And then he obviously drew both scrutiny and praise for his support of labor unions that he joined and was very visible on the picket line for the Kellogg's workers in Pennsylvania in 2021. He was a key player in negotiations between the unions and the freight companies that avoided the rail strike that would have disrupted the national supply chain.
Every country is battling with what we're battling here in the United States of America and how we develop the talent that different companies and industries need. I made a point to talk about that, to talk about growing our labor force. And I talked about, more importantly, we need to address inequality in a meaningful way, not just in the United States of America, but around the world. And leadership needs to come from across every sector that we have. That means business leadership as well as government. Labor needs to be at the table. You're at the table here in Boston, but around the country, labor's not at the table all the time. We need labor at the table.
Walsh was back in Boston on January 27th, speaking to the New England Council, and he insisted he's not just a labor guy, which was a challenge for him during his mayoral campaign.
How do I get my message across? They're saying I'm just a labor guy, and I'm not just a labor guy. I can be a business person, I can do this and that. And what we decided to do is, rather than run away from it, we decided to embrace it. And what I said was, I wear my labor credentials as a badge of honor. And I talked about, I made no secrets about who I was and what I was all about.
Now, this isn't Walsh's first foray into sports politics. Remember last year he offered to help end the lockout between Major League Baseball and the Players Union. And, you know, he is, as you mentioned, a major ally for Biden and organized labor. He was one of the top campaigners for Biden. He's traveled to 39 states last year to meet with workers and talk about the administration's agenda, tout success, jobs numbers. And there's no permanent confirmed chief to replace him at the Department of Labor. And this is, you know, amid this big contract fight with the West Coast ports threatening to clog up supply chains here in the U.S. So there's a lot ahead for the Department of Labor, and this is a big hit. They're expected to appoint Deputy Secretary Julie Sue as acting head of the agency. And there could be some pushback on that. She's liberal. She was the California Labor Secretary. So we'll see what happens there. He also, as Joe mentioned, is the second Massachusetts politician to jump into the national leadership position in the sports industry, with Baker leading the NCAA. And I'll end with this. I've been trying all day to find some sort of comment from Walsh on the NHL. What I did find was this. Remember in 2014 when the Bruins played the Montreal Canadiens in the playoffs? Yeah. Here's Walsh speaking to Montreal Mayor Dennis Coderre.
I'll be sending you down the Bruins shirt. You'll be fine.
I just bought you one, so you'll be okay.
Listen, I was in the forum when Cam Neely scored that goal over. What's that goalie's name again that you had? Roy, right? That's what it, was that his name?
Are you a hockey fan, Marty?
Just a little bit.
Okay. I'll teach you. It's always fun to have a friendly bet together.
Yeah. This is the last thing I'll say. After the Canadians won that, Walsh, then the mayor, had to fly a Montreal flag on City Hall Plaza, and he chose one that was like the size of a dish rag.
There you go. That's
it was
our guy.
So tiny.
That's our
funny.
Marty. Yeah. No
Boston.
Yeah. So he's a hockey fan, and and he'll be leading the players' union.
Yeah. No. Well, yeah. There's got a vote has to take place. They expect it to be unanimous, I guess, sometime in the next week or so. But you know, I think about those national television cameras tonight as the State of the Union's going on, and what are those announcers talking about? The cameras on Marty Walsh, you know, and even though he doesn't want the focus on him, it certainly will be.
Well, you know, and also it should be said, I mean, for all the praise he's getting, he has big shoes to fill. This Don Fehr, who's now the guy, made a name for himself in baseball. All that guaranteed money baseball has, that was Don. He's done this for hockey in some regard, and now Marty comes in, so an interesting legacy to follow, Joe.
No doubt about it. We're all familiar with the South Shore Plaza as a landmark, certainly there at the split there in Braintree. But we've also, on this program, spent a good deal of time talking about the future of malls and new uses for malls or additional uses for malls. And certainly we watched out there in Natick as they added housing to the puzzle out there. And now there's a proposal to add housing to a portion of South Shore Plaza. It's coming from a Florida-based real estate developer. They want to build two buildings, basically a residential complex, and it would be in the corner of the South Shore Plaza parking lot. Now, the company is Zom Living, and they want Braintree to approve. I guess one building would be 315 units, another would be 180 units, and that would be, I guess, for the over 55 crowd. Jim Dunlop is the managing director. He became the managing director of Zom back in 2020. He joins us now to talk us through this proposal for the South Shore Plaza. Jim, thank you very much for joining us. But first, tell us about Zom Living. We'd like to learn a little bit about your company first.
Sure. As you said, it's headquartered in Florida, but it's an older firm, about 45 years old, and is more of a national residential developer now. It expanded out of Florida to Texas markets, from there to Arizona, the Carolinas, the D.C. market, from there up into Baltimore and over into Chicago, and now our foray into the Boston metro area. It's a very design-oriented, quality-driven development firm that specializes in rental multifamily and rental senior housing.
So, Jim, so 495 apartments. I heard you and Joe talk about these over 55 units. I'm also curious, I mean, you must know this, affordable housing, whatever that means to whoever we're talking to, is a huge topic around here. Talk to us about the other units that are not over 55, and will they be, in some people's definition, affordable? In other words, will they house the working of folks that we seem to be so, you know, in dire need of?
That's a great focus. The two buildings, one is intended to be straightforward multifamily, market rate, In the other active adult product, as you said, 55 plus. Both buildings, however, our proposal is to have a component of affordable housing at 10%.
Braintree's max or its minimum?
Another great question. We are proposing 10% as a benefit to the project. The town of Braintree at this time does not have an inclusionary housing percentage. They are working on one, but it isn't passed yet. So, but we realize in the country and in Massachusetts and in the Boston Metro and including Braintree, the population's increased. The economy is doing really well. The population of 65 plus has increased, and there's a dire need for new housing. So we feel like we're hitting all those marks right now.
Jim Dunlop, our guest, he's the managing director at Zom Living. Boston Business Journal reporting, because when I first heard this, I was like, oh, this is going to do a whole redevelopment of the mall. But that's not the case. BBJ is reporting that you bought 9 acres of mall property from Simon Properties, which owns the mall, for $20 million. First of all, I guess I want to ask you, is that accurate? And then where are you in this process?
Well, we haven't purchased the property. We're under contract to purchase it. It is just under 9 acres. It's the southern edge between the parking for Nordstrom's and the reservoir. And you're right, the mall is over 100 acres, and this is 9 acres of it. And we're very early stages in the process of approval. We're under contract with Simon. But it's our, it's to purchase it, so it's our project, and we're leading the charge on that. It is intended to be a big step forward for the mall property as far as elevating the retail and moving into more of a live-work-play kind of environment. That's, I think you guys are alluding to, the adding of uses to mall properties is what's happening all over the country, and it helps the residential, and it helps the retail, and it helps the area. And this is kind of a Granite Street corridor commercial district that the mall sits in, and it is a big mall. It's 1.6 million square feet. So,
all right. So, Jim, let's get right to the opposition. Kelly Moore is quoted in the Boston Globe. I'm sure you've seen this. He's president of the North Braintree Civic Association. Among other things, he said, it's too big. We don't want the traffic. We don't want our schools to suffer. You got a lot of kids that might go in there. Then they got to turn around and educate the kids. We don't want more crime at the plaza. But there's also this. Moore and others suggest that there are better sites in Braintree, including one near the Red Line station. Gets people in and out of Boston. Are you willing to look at other sites, and are you willing to downsize? So those are two questions.
Well, we are early in that dialogue, including with Kelly Moore's group, but with the town councilors and the mayor and et cetera. It's very early in the process, and we are talking about all those concerns.
So can you say right now whether you're willing to downsize or move to a different location?
We can't move to another location. We have looked at other locations.
And you've ruled those out.
We have looked at other locations in their time. It's not as simple as picking, I wish.
Okay.
It was as simple as picking a site and moving forward. We strongly feel that this is not in a residential area. It's in a commercial area, and it is an appropriate location. And size, the 180 active adult building is exactly the size for that product type, and 315 multifamily units is a very common and very operating efficient size for multifamily as well. So we kind of feel like we got those pieces where they need to be. And to answer your question, we are here to coordinate and cooperate and be open and transparent and have a dialogue and talk about all those concerns that the neighborhood and the town have. So we are doing that.
Sure. Talking with Jim Dunlop. He is the managing director of Zom Living. Talking about their planned development there for the South Shore Plaza. To get inside Tom's question a little bit more, I'm curious as to, a big company like yourself, like Zom, I mean, how do they make this decision? How did you, why is this a spot that works for you and your company? And what kind of process is it for you to get to where you are today?
Well, it's been a probably a year and a half process just to get to this point. We have a relationship with Simon, and they had the suggestion, and we liked it, and we looked at the location and realized where Braintree is and what Braintree has for access to jobs and access to lifestyle in the mall, and really, really liked the opportunity. And so, you know, making a deal with the landowner, and then proceeding through due diligence, and then conceiving a project, and talking with all the politicians. We met with the mayor and all the town councilors early on, or you know, for the last year.
Well, the mayor's supposedly against it, according to the Globe.
He has concerns as Kelly does, and then North Braintree does. He has the same concerns, and we are anxious to have a dialogue with them about how we solve problems, and we do that very openly and straightforwardly wherever we build, and we're looking forward to furthering those conversations to see what the solution is.
So, Jim, at this point or at any point, what do you ultimately need? Do you need the sign off or a vote from the city council?
Yeah, so it's two stages, actually. It's a PUD process to create a little district.
So that's the
there.
Planning board, right?
That's the plan. That's the town council.
Okay.
And part of that process is the planning board review. That is the next step that will be taken.
And this is cluster zoning, basically, right? PUD. Planned unit development.
PUD, planned unit development, right? And then once the town council takes that vote, it goes back to the planning board for a special permit.
All right. I guess here's what I'm getting at. I mean, I'm sure you guys will look at this very closely. Do you have the votes at this point to make this happen?
Oh, it's very early.
I know it's very early, but I know you've probably looked at this. So where does it stand right now?
Everybody has their concerns.
You got to bring people out to dinner is what you're telling me, right?
No. No, it's really sitting down and talking about what do they see, and what are their concerns, and what can I do to alleviate those. And everybody's a little bit different, but a lot of the common concerns are, the good news is Braintree residents and Braintree town councilors and mayor are all very passionate about their town.
Oh, sure.
So they care. So that we want to be in a community like that as well, because we care quite a bit.
Let's get to an update that I've been looking forward to. 10 years ago or more, I paid a visit to the folks at Boston University's CTE Center. This is the brain disease that football players are known to have. And this group of folks really pioneered all this. Chris Nowinski was a Harvard football player, went on to do some professional wrestling. And he teamed up with some very important doctors in all this to see just how this disease works, just how many football players had it, and what could they do about it. It did alert, it got the attention of the NFL and certainly of everybody else, even those who have kids in youth football. Let's bring in Dr. Ann McKee, who's one of the key parts of all this. Doctor, it's good to talk to you again. It's been 10 years, and I know you probably talked to a lot of media, but you brought me out, or I met you at the Bedford VA, and you showed me actually some samples, some brains, and you guys really do the nitty-gritty. You have a new data point, as it were. Why don't you explain that to us?
Right. So we have a new data point, meaning that we've now looked at 376 former NFL players. We've evaluated their brains, and we found that 345 or 91.7% had CTE. Now, the caveat is this is a brain bank. This is a brain donation program. So it's not representative of the general public or the NFL as a whole. But the fact that we don't solicit for these brains, they come in from families who are concerned, and the fact that we've found CTE so easily in such a high percentage of these NFL players, whereas it's rare, 0 to 3% in a community brain bank, it says there's a problem and we need to do something about it.
Well, Dr. Ann McKee is our guest. Well, what does this say? I mean, if you're at 91.7%. out of 376 former players having CTE. What does that say about the NFL today? Or does it say anything at all because they've, you know, essentially, well, supposedly changed their ways?
Well, I don't think, you know, they've definitely emphasized concussion and concussion management, and that is very important, and they've made great strides. But we have found over and over again in our work that it's the number of years of playing football. It's the smaller hits, the what we call the non-concussive hits, the little hits that people play right through, no symptoms, don't stop. Those are the hits that over time accumulate and increase the risk for CTE. Mm. And we found in our research that just 2.6 years of football doubles your risk for CTE.
Dr. McKee, I'm wondering, you do talk to these families, and I'm sure they call you, they reach out, and we have, you know, you've acknowledged this is a self-selective group, but still, there must be, and I learned a little bit about this when I did some work on this, there must be behaviors common to these folks that actually, you know, make these family members call you. I mean, talk about the common thread here. Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. So the changes are, well, you've probably heard about it, but the pronounced changes are changes in behavior and personality. They become impulsive. They may become violent physically as well as verbally. They have difficulty with judgment and difficulty with depression and sometimes suicidality. They just have a change in personality. And then as the disease gets worse, they develop cognitive problems that can lead to dementia. And what's interesting about this brain bank selection is that these families who are not qualified doctors, they're able 91.7% of the time to identify the symptoms of CTE.
Yeah. Doctor, I was curious to read that this condition can be treated. Talk to us a little bit about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's the symptoms can be treated. The symptoms of aggression and feelings of loss of control, depression, suicidality, those symptoms can be treated. We still don't have a cure or a treatment for the neurodegenerative disease, CTE, just like we don't have a treatment for Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. Hmm. We're working on it, but we don't have that treatment. But what we can do is provide compassionate care, treat their symptoms, and give them some peace of mind that this isn't a willful behavior. This isn't something that they just can't, you know, this isn't something, a weakness of their constitution. This is a disease, and the disease is affecting them. Just knowing that,
Is it reversible, doctor, if somehow somebody did? No, it's not reversible.
No. Okay. And it progresses. It progresses even without head trauma.
So, doctor, like I said, about 10 years ago or more, there was at least discussion about whether or not there was some link between Alzheimer's and dementia and this. I know that there's plaque that you see in the brain that is caused by these small hits, tau.
Tau.
Yeah, where's the understanding now? Has a link been made, or has it been dismissed between these very important and significant brain diseases?
Yeah, well, we know that CTE is a very distinct disease from Alzheimer's disease. The tau fibrils themselves are quite unlike Alzheimer's disease. And CTE does not require any beta amyloid plaque, and that is a necessary part of Alzheimer's. Right. But what we have found is that individuals early on do not have any hint of Alzheimer's disease. But as they get older and they get and their brain starts to deteriorate, they develop Alzheimer's disease at an earlier age, and it seems to progress more rapidly. But that's a second disease on top of the CTE.
Talking with Dr. Ann McKee, she's the director of the BU CTE Center. What don't you know about CTE that you want to know, doctor?
I think the most pressing issue in CTE research is how to identify it and make a diagnosis in life so we can really start trying some treatments and seeing if they're effective.
Yeah.
That's the holy grail, identifying it in life.
Before you have to examine posthumously. Right. Doctor, my final question, and I know everybody, or I at least know a family member on my wife's side who is a former NFL player who is worried. You know, he's in his 60s now, right. And he's worried that he'll someday become symptomatic. Final question, if you feel comfortable with this, is the NFL doing enough right now to prevent this kind of thing?
In my opinion, no. It's a preventable disease. But it actually is going to take some real rule changes and changes in how these players are monitored to make a difference. And also, they don't take care of the retired players. The retired players have a lot of trouble finding help. And help is out there. They need people that are worried need to come in and be seen. We can help them with the symptoms, and we can help them deal with what they're going through.
How does football have to change in specifically? Things have to change on the field? Do you away with hits?
Yeah, I do. Football is a collision sport. Tackling is an intrinsic part of every play of the game. That's what makes football a riskier sport than others. And, you know, really dealing with the risk for CTE means lowering the number of hits to the head, either by rule changes, limiting how much a player can play, starting to play at an older age, or, you know, reducing hits in practice and other things. It's going to take a concerted effort.
It's been 1 week since Massachusetts launched in-person brick-and-mortar sports betting in the Commonwealth. We, of course, provided a great deal of coverage on that day from MGM to Plainridge to Encore Boston Harbor. We wanted to check back in with some of these folks, see how the week went, see what they're seeing in terms of, Super Bowl bets and things like that. So we invited Chris Kelly, president of MGM Springfield, chief operating officer there, to join us today. He's on the line with us now. Chris, welcome to the program. It's been a week. Give us the good, the bad, the ugly. How's it going?
Well, thank you so much, and I would say it's been more the good. Certainly, about 7 days in, we've seen a lot of action. Not surprisingly, with the big game coming up, we've had thousands of bets now placed, and it appears that our guests at MGM Springfield believe in the Philadelphia Eagles. So we'll see where that ultimately plays out, but a lot of support from our team here for that one.
Chris, tell us something you didn't expect, whether it was the crowds, whether it was, something else. I mean, what was surprising to you about this opening?
Well, first and foremost, it went very smoothly. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of credit is owed to our Massachusetts Gaming Commission and certainly working with BetMGM that has operated in, well over 20 jurisdictions, I think helped us a great deal as well in training our team and in helping us to present this to our guests in the most positive way. But we also have a pretty sophisticated guest here in Massachusetts at this point when you think about the fact that they've been able to access sports betting in Rhode Island, in Connecticut, in New York, in New Hampshire. So the level of baseline knowledge of our Massachusetts residents, I think, has been a pleasant surprise for us and for them as well.
Is the first week revenue where you thought it would be?
I would say it's been directionally consistent with what we would have hoped for. We haven't really had a large betting event yet. The big game on Sunday will be the first opportunity to see what that looks like. And keep in mind as well that we haven't yet started a mobile environment in the state of Massachusetts. And traditionally, that's where the majority of bets are placed. So that will trail by a few months, which ultimately I think is a good thing for us. But we'll need to see that piece as well to answer that question more definitively.
Well, tell us exactly who your mobile partners are. Tell our listeners.
We partner with BetMGM, and they tend to occupy positions 1, 2, or 3 in every one of the 26 jurisdictions in which they operate. So a wonderful provider, a wonderful partner, and we think will create an outstanding experience for our guests. We already are from a brick-and-mortar standpoint, but not too far down the road in a mobile environment as well.
Chris, I'm on your Chris Kelly, by the way, is with us. He's president of MGM Springfield, talking about this first week of sports betting. I'm on the BetMGM website now, and I, as someone who doesn't bet that often, it took all I could to part with $20 on the first day. Bruins to win the cup, by the way. What is there any difference what I see on BetMGM the website and when I walk into your casino?
Well, I mean the overall experience I would say is markedly different.
It's different, but I guess
digital versus social.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was saying obviously website versus in person is different, but I guess as far as what I see and what I can bet on, what is there a difference?
Every jurisdiction has some unique rules around what you can bet on versus some others. So as you look state to state on the website, you might see some differences there. I would point out Ray Bourque matched your bet, although he bet $100 on the Bruins to win the Stanley Cup. He was one of our first bettors here on the property when we opened on the 31st. But that being said, the biggest difference, digital versus brick and mortar is the social experience of standing next to 100 other folks, cheering the game on. In the context of this Sunday, it will be well beyond that, and so that adds a dimension that is well beyond the numbers themselves, and I think one of the most fun parts of sports betting.
Our guest is the president of MGM Springfield. That is Chris Kelly, regular visitor to the program, also chief operating officer there. Now, under the rules in the state, you guys can have two mobile partners. I believe that Encore Boston Harbor has two. I think Plain Ridge has two. Now, you've made a business decision there just to have the one a mobile partner. Tell us about that.
Well, at this point, we're really focused on our partnership with BetMGM. Extremely excited about that. And, whether or not that second license comes into play or not is not something that we're considering at this point.
I have not had the occasion to be out there yet, Chris, but I know, for instance, I was at Encore Boston Harbor on the first day, and I know that they have this, they call it Express. It's a sports betting express. So you drive in to a portion of the parking garage. You can get out of your car and place a bet, get back in your car and go away. There's no drive through. You can't drive up and roll the window down. You have to get out of the vehicle. Is that something you guys have? Is that something you're thinking about?
We don't have that. We have a kiosk experience, which is essentially the model through which that operates. Mm-hmm. And so you have the ability to drive up, park your car, and within a relatively short walk, place a bet at a kiosk. So I would say it's a proxy for, but not the equivalent to what they've done at Encore. What's interesting, obviously we're only a week in, is the vast majority of bets that we're seeing here are not actually being placed through a kiosk at all. They're being placed at the counter with a person and through that medium, which is, it'll be interesting to see if that continues, but at least so far that's been the vast
percentage. So I can talk to somebody when I'm up there betting because, as somebody who doesn't do this regularly, I was a little bit lost with the kiosk at Encore. I couldn't figure out where my ticket came out, and I wasn't going to go away without a ticket. So a gentleman next to me who was placing many bets helped me with that. But so yeah, I can actually talk to someone, help me through this out at MGM.
You can, and I always recommend that for first-time bettors, or even if you've done it several times, it's great to have somebody walk you through it, make sure you understand. And we spend a tremendous amount of time on our training just to create the best experience we can for our guests.
Chris, we had earlier in the program our Bloomberg reporter Jerry Smith talking about an Associated Press report that some 50 million Americans will place a bet on the Super Bowl this coming weekend, and that is a record. It's like 1 in 5 Americans. I'm curious as to what promotions you're planning for this weekend and how important that Super Bowl bet is to MGM Springfield.
Well, we're really curious to see what it looks like, I think, more than anything, because we haven't had an event like this on the property before. So we are staffing to accommodate a significant influx of people, whether that's at the sports betting facility itself or the surrounding bars, food and beverage, et cetera. So we're anticipating a large crowd. We have some promotions for guests outside of the sports book that will be in place on Sunday as well. And so this is going to be a great learning opportunity for us, but we want to take advantage of the fact that we will have some guests here that may not have been to MGM Springfield before. And so having this property, you know, in its fullest extent available to them, I think is important to making sure they come back and experience the other aspects of an integrated resort like this one.
Yeah. Well, Chris, like any other business, your casino faces headwinds. I'm talking about staffing. I'm talking about inflation. Do you have enough people to make this work on Sunday? Do you have enough chicken wings? Do you have enough beer? I mean, where are your concerns?
Well, first and foremost, we will have enough chicken wings and beer, even if I'm out procuring them myself. We're going to cover the things that are most important, but I think, you know, within your question is just the challenge of how do you staff in an environment where we know, you know, workforce has been an impact of COVID and continues to be. It's something we think about on a daily basis. Is it going to impact our operations on Sunday? It isn't. But when you think about headwinds, continuing to retain the workforce, continuing to grow the workforce, those are certainly areas that we're focused on for 2023.
Is that area getting any better? Where are we on that curve?
Certainly better than the low point, but do I think we're in an environment that is, you know, consistent with what I'll call pre-COVID in terms of an employer like this one operating in Western Massachusetts and our ability to access a, you know, readily available workforce? I don't think we're back to that point. We may not be for a while. And so what types of strategies can a business like this one develop to make sure that we are competitive and that we're able to grow the talent that we do have within these four walls?
The developer of the Seaport, Legacy Place, and the street at Chestnut Hill is going green. WS Development just announced that it will purchase renewable energy to power 43 buildings in the Commonwealth. Our Janet Wu joins us now in the 106.1 studios with more on this big decision. Janet.
And these are big buildings, Tom. These aren't small buildings. Some of them are housing some of the biggest companies in Massachusetts. And as far as we know, WS is the biggest developer, the biggest private developer based here in New England to make this move. And it's not so easy as it sounds. It took 18 months to procure the contracts to power the size of their projects, which include the upcoming Amazon headquarters in the Seaport. WS says the move will reduce carbon emissions by 120 million pounds. That's equal to 146 million miles driven by an average passenger car. I sat down with WS Senior Vice President Yanni Sippis.
We recently announced that we would be purchasing all renewably generated power for 43 of our properties all over New England.
So it's 43 buildings, and many of these include iconic places in Boston right now. Name some of these specific buildings.
Sure. The power purchase agreement will cover 8 buildings that are part of our Boston Seaport project. That includes 1 Boston Wharf Road, which will be the new Boston tech hub for Amazon. It will also be the largest net zero carbon office building in the city when it's completed next year. It's about 700,000 square feet. The agreement also covers a building called 400 Summer Street, which is a 600,000-foot lab building, which will be the world headquarters of a company called Foundation Medicine. That will be completed later this year.
So in other words, this will cover buildings that already exist and buildings that will exist in the future.
That's correct. So the power purchase agreement also covers 35 existing mixed-use properties all over New England, including some iconic ones like Legacy Place in Dedham and the street in Chestnut Hill.
We are speaking with Yanni Sippis, Senior Vice President of WS Development. Yanni, WS is known for creating visual experiences around your projects like art displays, festivals, and events. This initiative is invisible, but how will it translate to carbon reduction?
Well, we did this because we care deeply about the communities in which our places are located. And we want to contribute to a more sustainable and verdant future for our region and our planet with this major commitment to renewably generated power. The power will come from the various hydroelectric facilities, mostly in Maine. And so while the generation may be invisible to the average consumer, you know, or office or lab worker working in one of these buildings, you know, the commitment speaks directly to our team's carbon neutrality goals. And it will help our residents and retailers and customers and researchers share in our commitment to a carbon-free footprint.
Can you tell me roughly how many people this affects as far as like the tenants in your buildings?
Well, the power purchase agreement covers about 14 million square feet of space. Much of that are existing retail places all over New England, but it also includes 8 buildings in the Seaport District that are home to thousands of employees in the retail, office, and research sector.
We are speaking with Yanni Sippis, Senior Vice President of WS Development. According to your news release, this will reduce emissions by 120 million pounds, which is the equivalent of 146 million miles driven by an average car. That's pretty substantial. Are there other companies doing this? Or I should say, are there other developers doing this?
Yeah. We've seen in recent years several major educational institutions and healthcare institutions take this type of step. We believe that this commitment to green power is industry-leading in the private development world. We're not doing it for that reason. We're doing it because we believe in a more sustainable future for the planet. But we definitely hope that this example will help to illustrate the art of the possible for many of our peers in the industry, and in the aggregate will help the built environment become greener in the coming year.
I have to ask you, Yanni, how much more will this cost WS Development to switch completely to green energy for these 43 buildings?
Interestingly, the cost is relatively comparable to traditional so-called brown power that you buy from the retail grid. But because of the size of the load package that we were able to aggregate for this arrangement, we were also able to secure a long-term rate certainty, which is very important both for us, and it inures to the benefit of our retail and office and lab tenants. And so that's a major part of the reason that we did this.
We are speaking with Yanni Sippis, Senior Vice President of WS Development, who leads the Seaport and Fenway projects. So take me to that room when you were sitting around the table discussing this. Was it a pretty fast decision?
The decision was an easy one, based on economics, based on this being the right thing to do, and based on the benefits that it would bring both to our own people and to many of our tenants. However, after making the decision, this deal took about 18 months to put together. It was not an easy thing to do. We worked very closely with an energy advisor to help match the load profile that we were bringing to the table to the list of available generators of this renewable power. And that took about 18 months to do. And so we're just able to complete it and are now rolling it out across our property.
Are you hoping that other developers and also companies will follow your decision?
Well, certainly for the sake of our region and the planet, yes. We now know that this is something that's possible, and we believe that others will look at this as an example and follow suit.
As far as you know, you're the largest Boston developer to do this so far?
As far as we know, yes. You know, there may be others around the country. I don't have visibility into that, but as far as we know, we're the largest Boston-based developer to enter into a power purchase agreement of this type for a portfolio of this size.
Again, 8 of the buildings are in the Seaport. Not all of them are actually built yet. This includes One Boston Wharf Road. He mentioned that 700,000 square foot complex that is fully leased to Amazon and will be the Amazon headquarters here in Boston. That building will also set a milestone as it will be their first net carbon zero large office building.
So, Jenna, yeah, you mentioned a couple of these buildings. Can you give us some more on that score?
Yeah, so it's really the big complex that WS is known for. The street in Chestnut Hill, which actually happens to be where they are headquartered. Also Legacy Place, the retail location of One Seaport, which has many, many stores. That's also a very large complex. Mm-hmm. But in total, 43 buildings. We have not heard yet what's going to happen in the Fenway. We know that they're very key in all of that redevelopment, but that's very early in the process. Mm-hmm. Many of those buildings are just breaking ground now. So what's very interesting about this, though, is that, again, as I mentioned at the top of this, these aren't small buildings. These are large buildings. They pretty much run the gamut of every type of building because there is residential, there's lab space, research space, retail, offices. So basically they're covering all the bases.
You know, Jenna, and given that the costs are pretty much a wash here when you have this obvious choice, I would guess it's a pretty powerful marketing tool.
Well, it is, but the question remains, will other developers be able to do this? Because one of the reasons why they're able to get an attractive cost is because they're buying in such huge scale. For it to take 18 months for them to find providers that could give the power that is needed for these buildings. So remember, some of these buildings are 24/7. When you have a research lab, it's not as if you can switch off the lights at night and then, you know, save on your electricity. As you heard him say, a lot of the energy is actually local. It's from Maine, hydroelectric dams in Maine to our north. And we imagine that those providers are also scaling up as well. Remember, this is a big transformation. This is a big push.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, did Yanni get into that at all? That one of the problems, one of the reasons it took 18 months is that, man, it was hard to find. And then the next guy up, it might even be harder at this point. Is there enough available, I suppose?
I don't know that answer. Yeah. These contracts are for 7 years, so it's quite a bit of time. And again, they had to get quite a few contracts because it's covering the 43 buildings. So that is a big task. As you heard them say, they had to hire a consultant to work on this. It's not just something that you can do, like we get our energy bills and said, would you like to check the box and switch over and pay a little bit more? It's different when it has these large buildings. And again, they're a private developer. So it is a big example.
Yeah. Not a common thing in that universe.
I've just been handed an urgent news story.
News flash coming your way right now.
This is the number one rule, okay?
This is big news.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
Yeah, now it's time for the number one red story in the Bloomberg Terminal in the past hour. Headline, Newman says his apartment tenants will plunge their own toilets. In Adam Newman's residential real estate company, Flow, he's hoping that if residents feel like owners, that they will feel like owners, regardless of their actual equity ownership. They'll plunge their own toilets instead of calling the superintendent. That was one of the takeaways from a talk Newman gave at a conference organized by Flow's major venture capital backer, Andreessen Horowitz. The investor released new footage this week from the closed-door event, which took place in November, the first time Newman spoke at length about his business. That's the number one red story on the Bloomberg Terminal in the past hour, and I just want to remind our listeners that Bloomberg 1061 is now on Amazon Alexa. You can listen live 24 hours a day. Anywhere you have an Alexa device, catch Bay State Business plus business news market headlines 24 hours a day. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1061 FM.
Let's talk a little bit about tomorrow. Lots to get to. We got, as a run-up to the Super Bowl, we continue to talk about sports betting, about the game itself. We're going to talk to Tim O'Brien. He's part of our opinion group here. He had a story today I found fascinating that the corruption involved in sports betting, sort of the dark side of all this. And, Joe, we have Disney earnings. Gita Ranganathan will be with us. Bloomberg Intelligence analyst will be with us. We're also going to talk about this push on Beacon Hill for a new minimum wage. The group Raise Up, the coalition that got this started in the first place, they want it to go up to $20. John Hurst, the Retail Association, will be with us. He is strongly opposed. That should be a good discussion. All right. We are looking forward to it tomorrow, Bloomberg Bay State Business. But right now, Joe Matthew with Sound On starts right now.